Hello, my name is Greg, and I'm a reader with the Talking Information Center. For the next hour, I'll be reading you the BBC World News for Tuesday, February 17th, 2026. We are the day after the President's Day holiday. Everyone's getting back into the swing of things for work and school. So there's as usual, there's a lot happening in the world today. So we're going to jump right into the stories and see how many we can read over the next hour. The headline of the first story is U.S. Senator Mark Kelly tells the BBC he will seriously consider a White House run. U.S. Democratic Senator Mark Kelly has said he will seriously consider running for president in 2028 as he battles the Trump administration over a video in which he urged military personnel to refuse illegal orders. The Arizona senator, who was accused of seditious behavior by Donald Trump over the November clip, said he and his wife Gabrielle Giffords received many death threats after the president's comments. "We get them on a weekly basis now," he told BBC Newsnight. "We had to get security to protect us 24 hours a day." Asked if he was considering a White House run, the retired Navy captain said he was considering it, quote, "because we are in some seriously challenging times." The 61-year-old, who is a former astronaut, noted he was very different from most senators. "I'm one of the very few engineers. I'm the only person with a graduate degree in engineering in the United States Senate. I have combat experience. That's kind of rare. I spent 25 years in the military," he said. He added, "It's a serious decision. I just haven't made it yet." Kelly, 61, and five other lawmakers who had all either served in the military or had roles in intelligence have been targeted by the government after they published a 90-second video encouraging troops to disobey orders they deemed illegal. It was released at the time of rising questions over the legality regarding American strikes on alleged narco-trafficking boats off the coast of South America. The Pentagon has since tried in vain to demote his military rank, and a grand jury have declined to charge him with seditious conspiracy. But Kelly said he expected Trump to continue his legal actions against him. He added, "This is not going to end by me going away. I'm going to continue to fight this thing, even if it goes all the way to the Supreme Court." Critics of the Trump administration have called the government's crackdown on the six lawmakers an attack on free speech and said it was another instance of the president seeking to punish those he perceives as political enemies. Kelly said the death threats he received were also aimed at his wife Giffords, who was nearly assassinated as a member of Congress in 2011 when she was shot in the head. "Donald Trump is so reckless about what he says," Kelly said. "There are folks out there that, you know, react to what he said, and people listen to him." The BBC has contacted the White House for comment. Among other Democrats considering a presidential run are Kamala Harris, who lost to Trump in 2024, and California Governor Gavin Newsom. In a BBC interview in October, Harris said she would possibly be president one day and was confident there would be a woman in the White House in the future. Despite the 22nd Amendment of the U.S. Constitution barring presidents from seeking a third term, Trump has not ruled out such a possibility. However, he has also suggested Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio as potential successors, calling them unstoppable. So, interesting story. Senator Mark Kelly from Arizona. One of the first people to indicate he's at least thinking of running for the presidency. It'll be interesting. That whole 2028 election campaign will start up shortly after the midterm elections in November of this year. So we'll see how many people decide that they want to become president. The headline of the next story reads, Hillary Clinton accuses Trump administration of Epstein files cover-up in a BBC interview. Hillary Clinton has accused U.S. President Donald Trump's administration of a cover-up over its handling of files related to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. "Get the files out. They are slow walking it," the former U.S. Secretary of State told the BBC in Berlin, where she attended the annual World Forum. The White House insisted that by releasing the files, they have done, quote, more for the victims than Democrats ever have. Millions of new files relating to the late sex offender Epstein were released by the U.S. Department of Justice earlier this month. At the time, the Deputy Attorney General said 3 million pages were not released due to the existence of personal medical files, graphic depictions of child abuse, or other material that would jeopardize investigations. When asked whether Andrew Montbon Windsor should go before a congressional committee, Hillary Clinton said, "I think everybody should testify who is asked to testify." Appearing in the files is not an indication of wrongdoing. Andrew has always denied any wrongdoing. The committee does not have the power to compel him to appear in front of them, but put pressure on the Clintons to do so, which they agreed to last month. Bill Clinton will make his appearance on February 27th, and Hillary Clinton will appear the day before. A planned vote to hold the Clintons in contempt of Congress for initially refusing to appear was shelved after the pair agreed to testify. It will be the first time a former U.S. president has testified to a congressional panel since Gerald Ford did so in 1983. Hillary Clinton reiterated the couple's call for their congressional committee hearing to be in public rather than a closed-door deposition. "We will show up, but we think it would be better to have it in public," Hillary Clinton told the BBC. Republican Committee Chair James Comer had accused the Clintons of delay, saying the pair caved as a contempt vote loomed. "I just want it to be fair," said Hillary Clinton. "I want everybody treated the same way. We have nothing to hide. We have called for the full release of these files repeatedly. We think sunlight is the best disinfectant." The former presidential candidate argued that she and her husband were being used to divert attention away from Trump. "Look at this shiny object. We're going to have the Clintons, even Hillary Clinton, who never met the guy." Hillary Clinton said she had met Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's convicted associate, on a few occasions. Bill Clinton, who was featured in the Epstein files, was acquainted with Epstein, but said he cut off contact 2 decades ago. Neither Clinton has been accused of wrongdoing by survivors of Epstein's abuse, and both have denied knowledge of his sex offending at the time. The millions of new files relating to Epstein that were made public by the U.S. Justice Department earlier this month, after Congress passed a law requiring the agency to release material related to investigations of Epstein. The Department of Justice has now said it has released all of the files required by the Epstein Files Transparency Act, but lawmakers have argued the release is insufficient. Kentucky Republican Representative Tom Massey, who co-wrote the law, called for the DOJ to also release internal memos outlining past decisions on whether to charge Epstein and his associates. Epstein took his own life in prison, in a New York prison cell, on August 10th, 2019, Epstein took his own life in a New York prison cell on August 10th, 2019, as he awaited, without the chance of bail, his sex trafficking charges. Trial on his sex trafficking charges. It was more than a decade after his conviction for soliciting prostitution from a minor for which he was registered as a sex offender. Andrew, the former prince, has faced growing pressure from some U.S. officials and the family of his prominent accuser, Virginia Giuffre, to testify before the Oversight Committee about his links to Epstein. Andrew has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing and reached an out-of-court settlement with Giuffre in 2022 containing no admission of liability. Giuffre died by suicide in 2025. Trump, who is mentioned in the Epstein files, has consistently denied any wrongdoing in relation to Epstein, with whom he says he severed contacts decades ago, and has not been accused of any crimes by Epstein's victims. When asked about Hillary Clinton's comments in the interview, Trump told the BBC he had nothing to hide. I've been exonerated. I had nothing to do with Jeffrey Epstein. They went in hoping that they'd find it, and they found just the opposite, he said, aboard Air Force One. They're getting pulled in, and that's their problem. Clinton and many other Democrats have been pulled in. In relation to the allegations against Trump, the DOJ has previously said some documents contain untrue and sensationalist claims against Trump that were submitted to the FBI right before the 2020 election. To be clear, the claims are unfounded and false, and if they have any shred of credibility, they certainly would have been weaponized against Trump already. The White House said by releasing thousands of pages of documents, cooperating with the House Oversight Committee's subpoena request, and President Trump recently calling for further investigations into Epstein's Democrat friends, the Trump administration has done more for the victims than Democrats ever have. So that's a little story about what is happening with the Epstein files. It's quite a hodgepodge of he said, she said. We'll take a look at a next story. The headline reads, "A sad day as the curling cheating row at the Winter Games unsettles Canadians." So if you've been a fan of the Olympics and watching some of the showings the last week or so, the curling has become a little contentious, and there's been charges of cheating against a number of countries. The story begins, "A scandal at the Winter Olympics has left the Canadian curling teams on the defensive and Canadians reeling over the crack in their country's polite persona. Over the weekend, Canadian curler Mark Kennedy had an expletive-filled outburst after Sweden accused him of cheating during a match and later said his team might be the target of a premeditated attack by their rivals. Kennedy was accused of double-touching, touching the stone a second time after initially releasing it down the ice. The next day, Canadian women's captain Rachel Holman was accused of using the same move. Both have denied the accusations, but Canada's curling teams, who historically have dominated the sport, now face questions over their tactics. While the curlers have shown their anger over the situation during matches, fans of the sport and Canadians have questioned whether the team acted in the spirit of curling. In a country well known for its niceness, the cheating row has stung for some. The BBC asked tourists and locals in Montreal what they made of it. It is a sad day for Canadian sport, said Tim Gray from Alberta. Integrity in the sport is important even if you have to call it on yourself. As Canadians, we aren't supposed to do these things, said Samar from Ontario. Without sportsmanship, said Dwayne from British Columbia, it's not a sport anymore. There was a more nuanced take at the Royal Montreal Curling Club. One of the curling instructors, Ankara Leonard, said the publicity could be good for the sport by generating interest. She added, "Do I think Kennedy's finger affects the rock? No, I don't. Do I think we have to play within the rules? Of course." The controversy began on Friday when Swedish player Oscar Eriksson accused Kennedy of double-touching. As the game continued, Kennedy and Eriksson got into a verbal back and forth that appeared to show Kennedy a verbal back and forth that included expletives. Their exchange quickly went viral as a video emerged that appeared to show Kennedy pushing the stone with his finger after releasing it. Kennedy got a verbal warning from the World Curling for using foul language, but he was not formally charged with cheating by the governing body. The next day, Kennedy said, "I probably could have handled it better. But we're human out there, and there's a lot of emotions. I'm not going to apologize for defending my teammates and standing up for myself. I've curled my whole life, never once with the intention of getting an advantage through cheating," he added. An opinion piece in the Canadian news outlet The Globe and Mail pointed to some of the frustration felt back home. "These Canadian curling teams are not fun bad guys. They come off like the sort of competitors who need so desperately to win that they will do anything, even things that are pointless, in order to get there." Cathal Kelly, the writer of the opinion piece, continued, "There's an easy way out of this. Stop struggling. Stop acting like our curling reputation matters more than our national one. Be the bigger man and woman, even if you don't think you did anything wrong. There was a second cheating row on Saturday when match officials accused the Canadian women's team of the same double-touch violation. Rachel Homan said there was a 0% chance there had truly been a violation, as she and her teammates looked on in frustration. The Canadians lost to the Swiss 8-7. On Sunday, Great Britain's men's team was accused of the same violation. Both Homan and British men's curler Bobby Lamy had stones removed from play due to alleged violations. Homan later slammed the official's decision to remove her stone during a defeat to Switzerland, saying it was insane. All of the incidents led World Curling to clarify that double tapping is not allowed. During forward motion, touching the granite of the stone is not allowed. This will result in the stone being removed from play, they said. World Curling does not use video to review play, but they did send two officials to monitor how players release their stones in subsequent games. Curling columnist and Olympian Tommy Rantamäki, in an article for the Curling News, warned that Canada's dominance in the world of curling means its players should be mindful of the influence they have. Young players in Finland, Korea, Italy, Sweden, everywhere often copy what Canadian teams do. They copy the athlete's delivery, the sweeping, the tactics, the communication, Rantamäki wrote, and they copy the behavior. So it's interesting to see the controversy in the sport of curling and in the Olympics. It is actually a pretty cool sport to watch. I'm not sure. I've never done it before. It looks like a lot of fun. It looks pretty darn hard. The headline for the next story reads, how a dark web agent spotted bedroom wall clue to rescue a girl from years of harm. Specialist online investigator Greg Squire had hit a dead end in his efforts to rescue an abused girl his team had named Lucy. Disturbing images of her were being shared on the dark web, an encrypted corner of the internet only accessible using special software designed to make owners digitally untraceable. But even with that level of subterfuge, the abuser was conscious of covering their tracks, cropping or altering any identifying features, says Squire. It was impossible to work out who or where Lucy was. What he was soon to discover was that the clue to the 12-year-old's location was hidden in plain sight. Squire works for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security Investigations in an elite unit which attempts to identify children appearing in sexual abuse material. A BBC World Service team has spent 5 years filming with Squire and other investigative units in Portugal, Brazil, and Russia, showing them solving cases such as that of a kidnapped and presumed dead 7-year-old in Russia, and the arrest of a Brazilian man responsible for 5 of the biggest child abuse forms on the dark web. The unprecedented access shows how these cases are often cracked, though not through state-of-the-art technology, but by spotting tiny revealing details in images or chat forums. Squire cites Lucy's case, which he tackled early in his career, as the inspiration for his long-term dedication. He found it especially disturbing that Lucy was about the same age as his own daughter, and new photos of her being assaulted, seemingly in her bedroom, were constantly appearing. Squire and his team could see from the type of light, sockets, and electrical outlets visible in the images that Lucy was in North America, but that was about it. They contacted Facebook, which at the time dominated the social media landscape, asking for help scouring uploaded family photos to see if Lucy was in any of them. But Facebook, despite having facial recognition technology, said it did not have the tools to help. So Squire and his colleagues analyzed everything they could see in Lucy's room, the bedspread, her outfits, her stuffed toys, looking for any element which might help. And then they had a minor breakthrough. The team discovered that a sofa seen in some of the images was only sold regionally, not nationally, and therefore had a more limited customer base. But that still amounted to about 40,000 people. At that point in the investigation, we're still looking at 29 states here in the U.S. I mean, you're talking about tens of thousands of addresses, and that's a very, very, very daunting task, says Squire. The team looked for more clues, and that is when they realized something as mundane as the exposed brick wall in Lucy's bedroom could give them a lead. So I just started Googling bricks, and it wasn't too many searches before I found the Brick Industry Association, says Squire. And the woman on the phone was awesome. She was like, how can the brick industry help? She offered to share the photo with brick experts all over the country. The response was almost immediate, he says. One of the people who got in touch was John Harp, who had been working in brick sales since 1981. I noticed that the brick was a very pink cast brick, and it had a little bit of charcoal overlay on it. It was a modular 8-inch brick, and it was square-edged, he says. When I saw that, I knew exactly what the brick was, he adds. It was, he told Squire, a flaming Alamo. Our company made that brick from the late 1960s through the middle part of the 80s, and I sold millions of bricks from that plant. Initially, Squire was ecstatic, expecting they could access a digitized customer list, but Harp broke the news that the sales records were just a pile of notes that went back decades. He did, however, reveal a key detail about bricks, Squire says. He says, bricks are heavy, and he said, so heavy bricks don't go very far. That changed everything. The team returned to the sofa customer list and narrowed that down to just those clients who lived within a 100-mile radius of Harp's brick factory in the U.S. Southwest. From that list of 40 or 50 people, it was easy to find and trawl their social media. And that is when they found a photo of Lucy on Facebook with an adult who looked as though she was close to the girl, possibly a relative. They worked out the woman's address and then used that to find out every other address connected with that person and all the people they had ever lived with. That narrowed Lucy's possible address down further, but they didn't want to go door to door making inquiries. Get the address wrong, and they could risk the suspect being tipped off that he was on the authorities' radar. So Squire and his colleagues began sending photos of these houses to John Harp, the brick expert. Flaming Alamos were not visible on the outside of any of the homes because the properties were clad in other materials. But the team asked Harp to assess, by looking at their style and exterior, if these properties were likely to have been built during a period when Flaming Alamos had been on sale. We would basically take a screenshot of that house or residence and shoot it over to John and say, would this house have these bricks inside? Says Squire. Finally, they had a breakthrough. They found an address that Harp believed was likely to feature a Flaming Alamo brick wall and was on the sofa customer base list. So we narrowed it down to this one address and started the process of confirming who was living there through state records, driver's licenses, information on schools, says Squire. The team realized that in the household with Lucy was her mother's boyfriend, a convicted sex offender. Within hours, local Homeland Security agents had arrested the offender who had been raping Lucy for 6 years. He was subsequently sentenced to more than 70 years in jail. Brick expert Harp was delighted to hear Lucy was safe, especially given his own experiences as a long-term foster parent. We've had over 150 different children in our home. We have adopted 3. So doing that over those years, we have a lot of children in our home that were previously abused, he said. What Squire's team do day in and day out, and what they see, is a magnification of hundreds of times of what I've seen or had to deal with. A few years ago, that pressure on Squire started to take a real toll on his mental health, and he admits that when he wasn't working, alcohol was a bigger part of my life than it should have been. At that point, my kids were a bit older, and you know, that almost enables you to push harder. Like, I bet if I get up at 3 this morning, I can surprise a perpetrator online. But meanwhile, personally, who's Greg? I don't even know what he likes to do. All of your friends during the day, you know, they're criminals. All they do is talk about the most horrific things all day long. Not long afterwards, his marriage broke down, and he says he began to have suicidal thoughts. It was his colleague Pete Manning who encouraged him to seek help after noticing his friend seemed to be struggling. It's hard when the things that bring you so much energy and drive is also the thing that's slowly destroying you, Manning says. Squire says exposing his vulnerabilities to the light was the first step to getting better and continuing to do a job he is proud of. I feel honored to be a part of the team that can make a difference. Instead of watching it on TV or hearing about it, I'd rather be right in there, in the fight, trying to stop it. Last summer, Greg met Lucy, now in her 20s, for the first time. She told him her ability to now discuss what she went through was testament to the support she has around her. I have more stability. I'm able to have the energy to talk to people about the abuse, which I could not have done even like a couple of years ago. She said at the point Homeland Security ended her abuse, she had been praying actively for it to end. Not to sound cliche, but it was a prayer answered. Squire told her he wished he had been able to communicate that help was on its way. Your wish there was some telepathy, and you could reach out and be like, listen, we're coming. The BBC asked Facebook why it couldn't use its facial recognition technology to assist the hunt for Lucy. It responded, to protect user privacy, it's important that we follow the appropriate legal process, but we work to support law enforcement as much as we can. Quite a story from this Homeland Security or guy that was tracking down this girl, and all of his hard work finally paid off. We'll take a look at a story you might have heard on the news that Reverend Jesse Jackson died yesterday or early this morning, 84 years old, certainly a huge figure in American civil rights. The headline for this story is How Jesse Jackson Paved the Way for Barack Obama and Helped to Change the United States. Jesse Jackson, a key figure during the U.S. civil rights movement of the 1960s, was known for being the first African-American to make the jump from activism to major party presidential politics. A protege of Martin Luther King Jr., Jackson built a career around working to politically organize and improve the lives of African-Americans and became a national force during his two White House campaigns. While other African-Americans sought the U.S. presidency, Jackson was the first to find significant success at the ballot box, which would pave the way for those who come after, including Barack Obama and Kamala Harris. Over the course of his career, Jackson built a movement to bring America's increasingly diverse population together with a message that centered on poor and working-class Americans. No one else in the Democratic Party was talking about a multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said at an event in Chicago in August 2024 that celebrated Jackson. This movement wasn't just about bringing us together, but about bringing us together around a progressive agenda. A gifted orator, Jackson articulated the frustrations of those who felt like second-class citizens in the world's most prosperous democracy. His speech to the 1988 Democratic National Convention, which ended with the refrain, "Keep Hope Alive," would be echoed decades later in the Hope and Change slogan of Obama's successful 2008 presidential campaign. After his historic run of presidential campaigns, Jackson went on to position himself as an elder statesman within the Democratic Party. However, Jackson's later years would be punctuated by scandal, including revelations of marital infidelity and financial impropriety involving his son and political heir, Jesse Jackson Jr., who served as a congressman from Illinois. In 2017, the elder Jackson was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease and largely withdrew from public life. That diagnosis was subsequently changed to one of progressive supranuclear palsy, a degenerative brain disease with similar symptoms. Jackson was born Jesse Lewis Burns on October 8, 1941, in Greenville, South Carolina, the son of a 16-year-old Helen Burns. Unmarried, she was expelled from her local Baptist church after she became pregnant, the result of an affair with a 33-year-old married neighbor named Noah Robinson. When Jackson was two, his mother married Charles Jackson, who went on to adopt his new stepson. Jesse Jackson remained in touch with Robinson and regarded both men as his fathers. Charles Jackson was a religious man, and his son was brought up in the church, a traditional focus for black political resistance since the time of American slavery. Growing up in South Carolina, Jackson, like all black Americans, was segregated from his white neighbors. He was forced to attend separate schools and allowed only in designated areas in public places like buses or restaurants. In high school, Jackson did well, being elected as class president and excelling in nearly every kind of team sport. A football scholarship to the University of Illinois helped Jackson pursue his ambitions and escape his poor surroundings, but he soon transferred from the predominantly white institution to a historically black college in North Carolina. He said he left Illinois because his white coaches wouldn't let him play quarterback in American football, although that account is disputed. Records show the team already had a black quarterback, and Jackson was on academic probation. As a student in North Carolina A&T, Jackson gradually became involved with the civil rights movement. In 1960, he was arrested with seven other students after a silent demonstration in a whites-only public library, which led to the desegregation of the library. 4 years later, Jackson graduated and moved to Chicago, where he trained to become a religious leader and was noticed by King, the country's most famous civil rights leader. Through the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which King founded in 1957 to promote nonviolent action to seek social and economic justice, he established Operation Breadbasket. The operation encouraged black men and women to frequent businesses that gave them basic courtesy and job opportunities, and to boycott those that did not. Still in his 20s, Jackson was first asked to run the Chicago arm of the operation, and before long to take on the national leadership. In 1968, Jackson's life changed dramatically. He was with his mentor at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, when Martin Luther King was assassinated. Moments before the fatal shot, King was leaning over a railing in playful conversation with Jackson, who was standing in the parking lot below. Jackson told reporters that he cradled King's head as he died, although other witnesses did not confirm that account. The next day, Jackson controversially appeared on television with his clothes still stained with King's blood, assuming the mantle of civil rights leadership. "We were determined we would not let one bullet kill the movement," he later said. Jackson, like King had done in the years before his death, began speaking about America's problems as rooted in class inequality as much as racism. The principal schism, he said, was between the haves and the have-nots. "When we change the race problem into a class fight," he told the New York Times, "then we are going to have a new ballgame." 3 years later, arguments over leadership led Operation Breadbasket to fracture, and Jackson to form Operation Push, People United to Serve Humanity, a new wide-ranging civil rights group. In the years that followed, Jackson became one of the most influential political figures in America. His Push organization championed inner-city education and affirmative action programs that saw businesses employing black people. He remained a controversial figure, with allegations that he once made anti-Semitic remarks, and as an ordained minister and the result of an unwanted pregnancy, he opposed abortion. The issue was convulsing U.S. politics after the landmark Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade. Democrats who traditionally aligned with the civil rights movement mostly supported keeping abortion legal. "Human beings cannot give or create life by themselves. It is really a gift from God," he wrote in 1977. "Therefore, one does not have the right to take away that which he does not have the ability to give." He suggested that Moses and Jesus would not have been born. had abortion been a possibility in biblical times. In 1983, Jackson traveled to Syria to plead for the release of a captured American pilot, Lieutenant Robert Goodman. His mission was successful and greatly boosted his national profile. With black youth unemployment running at around 50%, Jackson then announced a run for president. His decision caused heartache for some of his natural supporters, including King's wife Coretta, who feared he would fail to win the Democratic Party's nomination and damage the chances of other progressive candidates. During the campaign, Jackson spoke about the Rainbow Coalition, a broad group of voters from a variety of races and beliefs who were traditionally disadvantaged and who, Jackson said, had been hurt by the policies of then-President Ronald Reagan, a Republican. Our flag is red, white, and blue, but our nation is a rainbow, red, yellow, brown, black, and white, and we are all precious in God's sight, he said in a speech at the 1984 Democratic National Convention, where he called for the party to unify. Jackson copyrighted the term and later founded a political action group with the same name. The move irritated some members of the Black Panther organization, who in the 1960s had used the term to describe an alliance between activist groups in Chicago. While Jackson ultimately lost the Democratic nomination, his campaign had become a political and cultural phenomenon. In 1984, he hosted Saturday Night Live, a popular weekly network television comedy program. His presidential bid also had a profound effect on Democrats. By winning more than 3 million votes and coming third during the primaries, he showed that a black candidate could rally nationwide support and possibly take the White House. At the same time, by running on a liberal platform, he brought many of the issues important to his party's left wing to the fore and gave them traction, such as universal health care and paying reparations to the descendants of slaves. Jackson was on record as a supporter of a Palestinian state and had called Israel's prime minister a terrorist. He also pledged never to use nuclear weapons first and to slash defense spending if he became president, positions that seemed impossible at the height of the Cold War. He tried for the White House again 4 years later and continued to campaign on a liberal agenda of higher taxes, increased public spending, and universal state-funded health care. Once more, he made an impressive showing, taking an early lead over Michael Dukakis, the eventual nominee, but once more he lost, this time after winning just under 7 million votes and 1,023 delegates to the Democratic National Convention. Those delegates went on to back reforms to the party's primary process that made it easier for insurgent candidacies like Jackson to compete for the party's presidential nomination without backing from the Democratic establishment. In 1991, Jackson tried to repeat his Syrian triumph and visited Iraq on the eve of the Gulf War to plead with Saddam Hussein to release Western hostages. A year later, he decided against a third presidential run, and despite his suspicion of Bill Clinton's centrist third-way politics, he lent his support to the former Arkansas governor. When Clinton found his presidency in peril after the public learned about his affair with Monica Lewinsky, a White House intern, he asked Jackson to counsel his family through the crisis. Jackson said that although Clinton had lied about the relationship, he did not deserve to be impeached for high crimes. Clinton had committed a little crime, he said. In 2001, Jackson was publicly called to account for his own affair when it was revealed he had had a relationship with a member of his staff and fathered a child. Jackson promised to take leave to revive my spirit and reconnect with my family, but the speed with which he returned to public life damaged his credibility with some clergy across America. He maintained a highly visible media profile with television shows and mercy missions, which some critics cast as self-promotion. In March 2007, Jackson pledged his support for Barack Obama's campaign to become the first African-American in the White House. Relations between the two men were initially strained after Jackson criticized Obama for talking down to black people. His remarks were picked up by a nearby microphone, and Jackson later apologized for his crude and hurtful remarks. But in the moments before Obama was due to make his victory speech in Chicago, the following November, a television camera picked out Jackson in the audience with tears streaming down his cheeks. Many of those watching suggested that Jackson's success in boosting black turnout in previous presidential campaigns had helped ensure Obama's victory. He later backed the new president's decision to support gay marriage, comparing the situation to the earlier struggle against laws in the country that had barred interracial marriage. While he continued to be a political force, he faced strain at home. In 2013, his oldest son, Jesse Jackson Jr., was convicted of using campaign money to fund his personal lifestyle and sentenced to 30 months in prison. 5 years later, Jackson was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease and had to step down as leader of Rainbow Push, the merged organization of his two earlier groups. Still, after George Floyd, an African-American man, was killed by police officers in 2020, Jackson traveled to Minneapolis to plead for criminal charges against the officers. And he was a loud voice in favor of withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan and for increasing the minimum wage. In 2024, Jackson applied for a presidential pardon for his son's conviction, but was refused by then-President Joe Biden. That year, the veteran campaigner also returned to the political realm he loved, making a rare appearance at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, where the party officially nominated Kamala Harris for president. High-profile delegates paid tribute to a man they said had done much to ensure a black woman had a significant chance of reaching the White House. Harris later lost the 2024 election to Donald Trump. "We learned at his feet," said Al Sharpton, a fellow veteran civil rights activist who had worked with Jackson at the Operation Breadbasket decades earlier. Pramila Jayapal, a congresswoman from Washington State, addressed him as she spoke at the convention, saying, "For every elected official we will see on that stage, we are here because you laid the path for us." So quite a story there, quite a career for Jesse Jackson. Again, passed away at the age of 84. We'll take a look at this story from Japan. The headline reads, "China is hitting Japan where it hurts. Will Prime Minister Takachi give in?" Last month at Tokyo's Uno Zoo, after receiving thousands of tearful goodbyes from Japanese fans, Zhao Zhao and Li Li were put on a plane bound for China, the latest symbols of the deteriorating relationships between China and Japan. The two giant Chinese pandas had to return home after Beijing announced it was taking them back, leaving Japan without any Chinese pandas for the first time in decades. Since Japan's Prime Minister Sane Takachi made comments that have plunged ties with China to their lowest level in years, Beijing has been piling on the pressure in a wide range of ways, sending warships, throttling rare earth exports, curbing Chinese tourism, canceling concerts, and even reclaiming its pandas. As Takachi begins a new term as prime minister after winning a historically strong public mandate from a recent snap election, analysts warn that both sides will find it difficult to de-escalate and the China-Japan relationship will not recover anytime soon. The row began in November when Takachi appeared to suggest that Japan would activate its self-defense force in the event of an attack on Taiwan. China claims self-governed Taiwan as its own and has not ruled out the use of force to reunify with it one day. The island counts the U.S. as its key ally, and Washington has pledged to help Taiwan defend itself. The worry has long been that any attack on Taiwan could result in a direct military conflict between the U.S. and China, and then widen to include other U.S. allies in the region, such as Japan and the Philippines. The issue of Taiwan is an absolute red line for China, which reacts furiously to any comment perceived as outside interference and insists that it is a question of sovereignty that only China can decide for itself. Almost immediately after Takachi's remarks, Beijing responded with a flurry of condemnation and demanded a retraction. Observers have noted that Takachi's comments were in line with the government's position and what other Japanese leaders have said in the past. But the difference is that it was the first time a sitting Japanese prime minister had voiced such views. For her part, Takachi refused to apologize or retract her remarks, a stance that analysts say may likely be vindicated by the strong mandate she has won. but she said she would be more careful about commenting on specific scenarios, and her government has sent senior diplomats to meet their Chinese counterparts. This, however, has done little to allay Chinese anger. Faced with Takachi's steady refusal to back down, China has piled on a steady stream of pressure. While spats have flared up between the two countries in recent decades, fueled by historical animosity, this time it feels different, say analysts. China has expanded its pressure on a much wider range of fronts, noted Robert Ward, the Japan chair for the think tank International Institute of Strategic Studies. It is a diffuse, low-level pressure that is similar to the gray zone warfare it conducts on Taiwan, he said, where it's aimed at wearing down the opponent to normalize things that actually are not normal. Diplomatically, it has lodged complaints with the United Nations and postponed a trilateral summit with Japan and South Korea. China has also tried to pull other parties into the fray and has called on the UK and France to side with it, while urging its allies Russia and North Korea to denounce Japan. Over the weekend, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi invoked Japan's World War II history of aggression while addressing Western leaders at the Munich Security Conference and called Takachi's remarks a very dangerous development. On the military front, Japan has claimed that China has sent drones, sailed warships past their islands, and its fighter jets have locked radars on their planes. Japanese and Chinese Coast Guard ships have confronted one another near the disputed Senkaku Diaoyu Islands, while last week Japanese authorities seized a Chinese fishing vessel. But it is clear that China also wants to hit Japan where it hurts its economy. Beijing has imposed restrictions on exports to Japan for dual-use technologies, including rare earth elements and critical minerals, in what has been seen as a form of economic coercion. It has also warned Chinese citizens to avoid Japan for their studies and holidays and canceled flights on 49 routes to Japan, leading to a drop in tourists and a slide in some stocks. Chinese nationals make up a quarter of all foreign tourists to Japan, according to official figures. Even entertainment and culture is not off the hook. Japanese music events have been canceled in China, including one where a singer was rushed offstage mid-performance, while film distributors have postponed the release of several Japanese movies. One of Japan's most famous cultural exports, Pokemon, was also criticized over an event that was due to be held at Yasukuni Shrine. The temple honors Japan's war dead, including some that China considers as war criminals. The event was eventually canceled. And on the social media front, Chinese online nationalists have launched attacks on Takachi, including sharing AI-generated videos showing pop culture figure Ultraman and anime character Detective Conan fighting the prime minister. But overall, China has taken actions that have been less provocative compared to previous conflicts with China, noted Bonnie Lin and Christy Govella with the think tank Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thus far, its economic and military responses have been relatively limited compared to the past, but there is ample room for further escalation, they noted in a recent analysis. China may also be holding back on going too hard on Japan, as it is currently actively positioning itself as the guardian of the post-World War II order and wants to be seen as a responsible power compared to the U.S., added Ward. Observers agree that if or when tensions calm down, they will likely settle at a higher level than before. Both sides are less likely to de-escalate this time around, noted Lin and Govella in their analysis. China is a much stronger power now, and Taiwan is the core of Chinese core interests, which means that Beijing is more likely to take a hardline position than in the past. Beijing is also deeply suspicious of Takachi and are likely to view her attempts to de-escalate without explicitly retracting her comments as hypocritical or even worse, strategically deceptive, they added. Meanwhile, Japan has a greater appetite to stand firm, especially with Takachi's huge electoral win, which she will take this as a vindication for her stance on China, noted Ward. So that's a update on what is happening in the relations between China and Japan. Take a look at this story. The headline reads, Bondi criticized after saying all Epstein files have been released. The U.S. Department of Justice has said it has released all of the files required by the Epstein Files Transparency Act, but lawmakers have argued the release is insufficient. A letter sent to members of the U.S. Congress on Saturday from U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi and her deputy said all documents held by the DOJ have been released. It contained a list of names appearing in the files. Kentucky Republican Representative Tom Massey, who co-wrote the law, called for the Department of Justice to also release internal memos outlining past decisions on whether to charge Jeffrey Epstein and his associates. Millions of new files relating to the late sex offender Epstein were released by the DOJ earlier this month. At the time, the Deputy Attorney General said 3 million pages were not released. This was due to the existence of personal medical files, graphic depictions of child abuse, or other material that would jeopardize investigations, said Todd Blanche on the day of the documents dump. In the latest letter, Bondi and Blanche wrote, in accordance with the requirements of the act and as described in various department submissions to the courts of the Southern District of New York, assigned to the Epstein and Maxwell prosecutions and related orders, the department has released all records, documents, communications, and investigative materials in the possession of the department that relate to any of 9 different categories. No records were withheld from the DOJ's release on the basis of embarrassment, reputational harm, or political sensitivity, the letter added. The individuals listed in the letter include people who are or were a government official or politically exposed person and whose name appeared at least once in the files, the letter says. The names appear in the files in a wide variety of contexts, including some people who had extensive direct email contact with Epstein or Maxwell, and others who were merely referenced in documents or news articles contained in the files, Blanche and Bondi wrote. Donald Trump, Bill Gates, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, and Bill Clinton, who are included in the list, all had documented past relationships with Epstein and Maxwell. There is no suggestion that appearing in the documents implies any wrongdoing, and each has denied any involvement in Epstein's crimes. But the list also includes the name of deceased musicians Janis Joplin and Elvis Presley. The letter was addressed to the Senate Judiciary Committee's Chairman Chuck Grassley and Ranking Member Dick Durbin, as well as the House Judiciary Committee's Chairman Jim Jordan and Ranking Member Jamie Raskin. In an interview on ABC this week on Sunday, Massey argued that even though the DOJ wants to say they are done with this document production, there are more crucial files that should be released. The DOJ was signing deliberative process privilege in order not to release some of the documents, he said. The problem with that is the bill that Ro Khanna and I wrote says that they must release internal memos and notes and emails about their decisions on whether to prosecute or not prosecute, whether to investigate or not investigate. In response to the letter, California Democratic Representative Ro Khanna, who co-wrote the Epstein Files Transparency Act, accused the DOJ of purposefully muddying the waters on who was a predator and who was mentioned in an email. To have Janis Joplin, who died when Epstein was 17, in the same list as Larry Nassar, who went to prison for the sexual abuse of hundreds of young women and child pornography, with no clarification of how either was mentioned in the files, is absurd, Khanna wrote on X on Saturday. Release the full files, he added. Stop protecting predators. Redact only the survivors' names. The BBC has contacted the Department of Justice for comment. U.S. lawmakers previously said files on Epstein were improperly redacted ahead of their release, excuse me, leading to at least one document being unredacted after their criticism. Lawyers for Epstein's victims have also said that the latest tranche of files included email addresses and nude photos in which the names and faces of potential victims could be identified. At the time, the DOJ said mistakes were due to technical or human error, and they had taken down all the flagged files. That's a little update on what is happening with the Jeffrey Epstein files. Let's see, take a look at what is happening again throughout the world. We're kind of getting close on time, but let's see what we've got here for news. The last story we'll take a look at is going to be a quick one. The headline reads, Nancy Guthrie's family cleared as possible suspects with the search in its third week. Police in Arizona say family members of Nancy Guthrie have been cleared as possible suspects. As speculation grows on social media about the whereabouts of the missing 84-year-old mother of NBC anchor Savannah Guthrie. The family has been nothing but cooperative and gracious and are victims in this case, said the Pima County Sheriff's Office, which has been leading the investigation. To suggest otherwise is not only wrong, it is cruel, the office said in a statement. The Pima County Sheriff, Chris Nanos, told NBC News that his office sent out the statement because people had been attacking the innocent. Nanos told NBC in a text message that kindness matters and that if it was every cop's duty to stand up and be that voice for our victims. The search for Guthrie, who police say went missing on the early hours of February 1st, is now in its third week, and no suspects have been named. Police have said Guthrie was taken from her home and that blood was found on the floor of her porch. A video taken from a doorbell camera at Guthrie's residence has shown the man believed to have seized her. He wore a mask, gloves, and a backpack. So there's a little bit more to that story, but unfortunately, we are out of time. It's been a quick hour. I want to thank you for listening to the stories I've selected to read today. I hope you have found them interesting and enjoyable. I look forward to reading the news with you again in the near future. Until we have that chance, I hope that life gives you many reasons to smile. Be well, my friends.